This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. There's a fault line in the Episcopal Church right now. On one side are those who want the church to ratify New Hampshire's choice of an openly gay man as bishop. And on the other are those who feel that would put their church out of step with Anglicans worldwide and perhaps out of step with their interpretation of Scripture. The man is Gene Robinson, and the story has been complicated by last-minute allegations. In the last half hour, we've heard news that the investigation of Mr. Robinson is now over, and a vote has been scheduled for later today. In a moment, we'll bring you the latest from the Episcopal Convention in Minneapolis. But whichever way this issue is resolved, the fault line stays. Some Episcopalians feel so strongly they say they will have to leave their church if the decision goes against them. Walking out to form a new group is called a schism, and it's nothing new. There was a great schism 1,000 years ago when Christianity split in two, and like a growing cell, it kept dividing and dividing. This hour, we'll talk about what issues were important enough to splinter religions, whether the divisions were over politics or theology, what history has to tell us about the prospects for reconciliation, and we want to hear from you about the issues that threaten to divide religions today. Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. And our email address is totn@npr.org. First, though, let's check in on the latest from the Episcopal Convention in Minneapolis. NPR's Barbara Bradley Haggerty joins us now from the convention. Barbara, good to have you on the program as always.
Thank you, Neil.
I understand that Presiding Bishop Frank Griswold has just issued a statement. Can you tell us what he had to say?
Yes. It was a very brief statement, one line. He basically said that the investigation is over, that the report by Bishop Gordon Scruton will be given this afternoon, and then they can proceed to vote on Gene Robinson's confirmation to be Bishop of New Hampshire. So we can't interpret too much. We can't say that he's been cleared or not, but we do know that things are kind of moving apace.
We do have a quote on the wire services, Barbara, from James Solheim, a National Church spokesman, who said the vote would not have been rescheduled if the Reverend Robinson had not been cleared.
Well, there we are. He knows a lot more than I do on these issues. I mean, the assumption would obviously be that he's been cleared. Otherwise, why would they go ahead and vote? But it's going to be obviously a very, very lively debate as well, because this just adds, you know, it adds to the controversy and to the emotion surrounding Gene Robinson. So it's going to be a really exciting afternoon. You know, this is not your mother's church convention, so to speak. It's been pretty exciting.
Well, remind us, all of this seemed set for a vote yesterday. What happened?
Well, what happened was that there were two allegations that came out mid-afternoon or early afternoon yesterday. Let's just talk about those. The first was from a man named David Lewis in Manchester, Vermont. He sent an email to his Vermont bishop, and he said that Gene Robinson and he had met a couple of years ago at a convocation, and that Gene Robinson had touched him inappropriately every time they had a conversation, and he felt Robinson didn't have the proper boundaries when it came to men. Now, there were no details about, you know, what that touching was all about, and no one has been able to reach Lewis to ask him really what's going on here. But people on the record say that Lewis is not an irresponsible person at all. I should also say, and you know, all of this will be ended when we get the report about Gene Robinson, but I should also say that there was a question about whether this email could even be a valid complaint. You see, he didn't sign it, obviously. It came by email. And afterwards, Lewis said that he didn't really want it to be public. So it's not even clear that this was a formal complaint that they could even consider, if you see what I mean.
Yeah, there was another complaint, though, this involving a website with which Mr. Robinson was associated, which may or may not have had links to pornographic sites.
Yeah, actually, it was, the issue is that Gene Robinson had been a founding member of a group called Outright. Outright is a group for gay and lesbian young people, you know, ages 12 to 21. And Outright is all over the country, but it's also in Concord, Massachusetts, which is where Gene Robinson helped found the chapter. Now, Outright has a website called outright.org, and it's that website that, it turns out, had links, and they've said this, had links to pornographic sites. What they've also said, what the outright folks have said, is that Gene Robinson was a founding member many years ago. He hasn't been associated with the group for a number of years, and that these links are relatively new, so that Gene Robinson could not possibly have known about the links to pornographic sites, which, by the way, have since been removed since all this came out. So that's the controversy. How much did Gene Robinson know about these pornographic links? And I think a lot of people think he didn't know anything about it.
And there is a suspicion, and we heard you talk about it earlier today, that these accusations coming up at the last minute and those making them say, look, I never thought it would come to this in one case, or we just found out about it. But it has the air of trying to swing the vote at the last second.
Well, it does have that air, and I think we have to be kind of careful and look at each one separately. Like David Lewis, even folks who are very supportive of Gene Robinson said this is often how victims act. They bottle it up, and then at the last minute, they kind of unburden themselves with their revelations. So people are taking David Lewis a lot more seriously than the other allegation. Now, the other allegation was brought forward essentially by a group that does that opposes Gene Robinson on theological grounds. It's a group called the American Anglican Council, and they were the ones who first brought it up. They brought it up to the lawyers of the church and said, look, would this website create any problem for the church? And so there's a little bit more kind of a cloud of suspicion around the second allegation than perhaps the first.
They also raised this issue with reporters, which you also mentioned in your conversation on Morning Edition earlier today. And, you know, that sort of raises the question, were they trying to get this charge out there without seeming to be responsible for being the originators of the allegation?
Well, you know, I think that's probably true. I mean, as one person who called me said, you know, we'd feel a lot better if this was broken by the press than by us. And, you know, the trouble is, what do you do with an allegation like that? It's, you know, 11 o'clock at night, and we can't reach Gene Robinson. We don't know how credible an allegation it is. And so the press, I understand CNN got it as well. We just kind of held back, because what do you do with that? So finally, the American Anglican Council went to the lawyers late on Sunday night and of the church and broke it themselves.
Given all of the remarkable attention that has been focused on this particular convention, what's the atmosphere there like?
Oh, my goodness. It's very, well, let me say, it's both calm and there's a surprising amount of comedy, even comedy in terms of, you know, it's a fairly genteel group here. They're being very polite to each other, even though they have very strongly divergent views. But there's also kind of a lot of confusion and people saying, you know, as you mentioned, I can't believe that it's come to this. The supporters of Gene Robinson say, you know, we had no idea, or we have a kind of an inkling, but we didn't really think that there was quite this much animosity toward the whole notion of having an openly gay bishop. We were really surprised and taken aback by kind of the level of emotion here and that it would possibly bring out these allegations. The other side, the conservatives have been relatively mute since the allegations came out. They've said, you know, Gene Robinson needs his day in court. He should be able to be cleared from this. And so they've been less aggressive since the allegations have come out.
And one of the things that was being discussed before this latest controversy erupted was some people saying, look, if this openly gay man is ratified as a bishop of the Anglican Church, we'll have no choice but to leave. Is there still talk of schism?
Yeah, there is talk of schism on a couple of levels. I mean, people, as you know, say that, and you mentioned this in your introduction, that there's a theological schism here, that some people, the conservatives, believe that the Bible is very clear that homosexual behavior is prohibited and the church should not condone it. And that is in many places the growing wing of the church. Many people believe that what could happen is there'd be a realignment, essentially, of the church with the conservatives creating their own kind of parallel structure to and offering a more conservative message than, say, what they see as the liberal side of the church. Now, you know, you just don't know what's going to happen. They say, the conservatives say that they're going to meet at some future date, no matter which way this vote goes, to decide what to do. You may see individual members leaving. I've heard a lot about that. But, you know, the liberals say there's always talk of schism. There was a talk of schism when we changed the prayer book, and there was a talk of schism when women were ordained for the first time, and nothing happened. People were unhappy, but we stayed together as an Episcopal church and part of the larger Anglican community. So, you know, you really, there's a lot of talk of schism, but you really don't know if it's going to happen.
Barbara, remind us, when do you now expect this vote to happen?
Let's see. They're going to have a closed session at 3:30 your time. The vote is going to, the debate is going to begin at 4 p.m. your time, East Coast time, I should say, and the vote will begin at 5 p.m. It could take about an hour to do the vote and to tally up the results, and I think we'll know by about 6 p.m. your time.
6 p.m. Eastern time,
yes,
this evening. Obviously, stay tuned to NPR News for the latest on that. I'm sure we'll be hearing from Barbara Bradley Haggerty later this evening. Barbara, thanks very much.
You're welcome.
NPR's Barbara Bradley Haggerty joining us from the Episcopal Convention in Minneapolis. Our focus this hour is on schism. What issues are important enough to drive divides between members of the same religious groups? What is their history? And what issues are important enough to splinter these religious organizations? Joining us now is Larry Cunningham, a professor of theology at the University of Notre Dame. He's with us from his office in South Bend, Indiana. Pleasure to have you on Talk of the Nation.
Nice to be with you. Thank you for inviting me.
The Great Schism, we mentioned that briefly earlier in the program. This was the split that we normally think of as between the Catholic Church and the Eastern Orthodox, and this is like 1,000 years ago.
That's right. Well, the formal split actually occurred in the middle of the 11th century, around 1054, but it had been brewing all the way back into the 9th century for very complicated reasons. I can tick them off very quickly. One, papal power being exercised over the Patriarch of Constantinople, when Constantinople's idea was that there were five equal patriarchs, differences over doctrine, and then one of the precipitating events was who was going to evangelize Bulgaria. Was the evangelization to come from the east, that is, from the Eastern tradition, from Constantinople, or from the west, from the Roman Church? And for a whole variety of reasons, these things got terribly complex, and the Pope and the Patriarch mutually excommunicated each other. And those excommunications were not lifted until the time of Pope Paul VI in the 1960s.
Is it common to have these brewing doctrinal theological issues that tend to get crystallized at some point around some tactical vote, like who's going to evangelize Romania?
Bulgaria.
Bulgaria, excuse me.
But, well, if you look at more recent history, I can give you three schismatic movements that happened within Roman Catholicism since the 19th century. One was the separation of the churches, some churches in Germany, Austria, and Switzerland, who refused to receive the doctrine of papal infallibility. And that little church, now known as the Old Catholic Church, still exists. The second one actually occurred in this country at the end of the 19th century, which resulted in the formation of what's known as the Polish National Catholic Church. And that was almost exclusively an ethnic argument of the Polish immigrants. I think it actually happened in Scranton, Pennsylvania, were terribly aggrieved by the what they considered the ham-handed authority of a largely Irish episcopate in this country, and separated. And remain separated to this day.
Larry Cunningham, I'm afraid we're going to have to wait for the third schism in the Catholic Church until after we come back from a short break. Can you stay with us?
Sure, absolutely.
And we'll also be joined at that time by Phyllis Tickle, who's going to be able to talk with us about some of the issues that are dividing religious groups today, and what are the most powerful issues that do divide religions and make things worth walking out for, at least in some people's minds. If you'd like to join the conversation, our phone number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. Our email address is totn@npr.org. I'm Neil Conan. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News.
Thank you.
This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. If you're joining us late, there is news out of the meeting of the leaders of the Episcopal Church in Minneapolis about the fate of the gay man who was a selected bishop in New Hampshire. His vote yesterday was tied up after allegations about his personal behavior were made. Those allegations have now been resolved, and a vote has been scheduled for later this afternoon in Minneapolis, so stay tuned to NPR News for word on what happens there. We're discussing issues that have divided faiths and denominations, past and present. They're known as schisms. Our guest is Larry Cunningham. He's with us from his office at the University of Notre Dame, where he's a professor of theology. And just before the break, you were talking about the three great schisms, or three schisms in modern Catholicism. You'd given us two. The third one is...
The third one occurred after the Second Vatican Council, in which certain segments of the Catholic Church refused to accept the reforms of Vatican II and went into schism, led by Catholic Bishop Marcel Lefebvre, now deceased. And you can still go around this country and find little Lefebvreite churches which still use the Latin liturgy, etc., and they're separated from Roman authority.
Our phone number again is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Our email address is totn@npr.org. And Nancy joins us on the line from San Francisco.
Oh, good morning.
Good morning to you.
Good afternoon to you all.
Well, we're getting a little confused on, yes, we can. We're all getting confused on what time it is where, but it's afternoon
okay.
Here.
Neil, it's just a pleasure to speak with you.
Thank you.
As I said, I am a descendant of a woman named Anne Askew, who was burned at the stake by the order of Henry VIII in 1746 over the whole issue of transubstantiation. And so I feel as though I carry in my blood the fire of all religious issues, and I was raised in the Episcopal Church. I have since formally left in that I have taken refuge in the Tibetan Buddhist system, but my heart is so, and I was a delegate to a convention, an Episcopal convention. I was part of the diocese here in San Francisco, Northern California. So my heart is very much with the agony that's going on in Minnesota. But I really want to say that I think that as painful as all of this is, that schism is very healthy because it is addressing these very crucial issues about how we are going to have humanity towards everyone who walks. And so that's where I am.
Do you think your ancestor would agree with you?
I beg your pardon?
Do you think she would agree with you that schism was a healthy thing? It wasn't healthy for her.
That Anne would say that?
Yeah.
I don't know. I think she was a bit. she was a bit more of a. I want to not martyr. Well, she ended up being martyred, and martyrs don't do very well. In case you all have noticed, they usually do end up being martyred. But to have that kind of a faith is astonishing to me. And I believe the people in Minneapolis are suffering because they have this profound faith. And so it's a growth process for everyone there and for all of us. I mean, it's getting national coverage. It's wonderful, I think. I think it's very healthy.
Well, Nancy, thanks very much. We appreciate it.
Okay, thank you.
Bye-bye. Larry Cunningham, remind us, she's talking about one of the arguments that indeed caused the foundation of the what we call the Episcopalian Church, the Anglican Church.
Right. Henry VIII hardly had her ancestor burned at the stake since he lived in the 16th century. And when the Anglican Church was founded, they rejected the doctrine of transubstantiation. So I'm not quite sure what she was referring to. But that's a very interesting point, because the great point of contention at the beginning of the divide of the Church of England from the authority of Rome had to do with who had the final say in the church. So it was a socio-political issue as a precipitating event, and then it became much more complex.
Well, joining us now is Phyllis Tickle. She's the contributing editor in Religion at Publishers Weekly and the author of The Shaping of a Life, A Spiritual Landscape. She joins us from member station WKNO in Memphis, Tennessee. And it's good to have you back on Talk of the Nation.
Thank you. It's good to be back.
Let me ask you a question. I understand you're a member of the Episcopalian Church.
I am indeed. I need to put that right out there. I am, and I loved what Nancy had to say. We should hear her again.
Well, what is your take? Is the church really facing a schism, a split here?
I think that that's possible. My suspicion is that it won't happen. What Susan Russell said at the top of the hour is very true. We've been here before and managed to survive. It could happen. I pray God it will not. Even if I were not an Anglican, I would make that prayer. But I think we also need to put what's happening in Minneapolis in perspective. We need to understand that what's happening there is a mini-cosm, so to speak, of what's happening in most of the mainline churches. This same division on this very same issue has been a roiling mess for United Methodist Church, for the Presbyterian Church in the USA. All of them have come up against this issue. And after a while, the issue, for those of us who are paid to watch religion, and now I'm speaking not as an Episcopalian, just as an observer or as a student of American religion, for all of us, there comes that time when you begin to say that the homosexuality thing is, it's certainly not a paper tiger, but it's the token being pushed back and forth. It's representative of a much larger issue. And that much larger issue is basically, I think, the authority of literalism or the authority of Scripture as literally received, vis-a-vis the authority of Scripture under a system of progressive revelation. This cannot be separated, I think. I think it's fool's errand to try to separate what's happening in Minneapolis from the fact that religion is a culture. And any time a religion changes, any time a culture changes, there's pain. Nancy was absolutely right. Schism is the best thing sometimes that can happen. Schism is not necessarily the work of the devil. It is a healthy sign of growth. Inherent in Protestantism, however, let me quickly say, is far too great a tendency toward schism sometimes. Lacking a central authority, as for instance Rome has, we bop into denominationalism and into splitting off and into splintering within Protestantism far more easily than perhaps would be good for us. But there's much wisdom in what your caller had to say, I believe.
Well, in that case, let's venture another caller. Let's go to
Joan
now, who joins us from Farmington Hills in Michigan.
Hi. My question pertains to the issue of conscience. In the past, in the far past, for example, in the Catholic Church, if you ate meat on Friday but thought it was Thursday, that wasn't considered to be a sin. Well, it would seem to me that the bishop-elect and probably all gay people, in their conscience, in their heart, believe that they are not sinning. Well, how does the church deal with that issue when people absolutely don't believe that they're wrong in this regard?
Phyllis Tickle, that seems to go to the heart of a lot of the pain that people are feeling.
Well, that's a stumper of a question. I don't know how the church, or whether there even is an answer about how the church, per se, as such, would deal with that. Obviously, they have dealt with that very question, and it has to do with on a sliding scale. The answer generally has to do on a sliding scale of the seriousness of the act in question. But as in terms of a sliding scale on homosexuality, I don't know how the church would deal with it or if it could be dealt with by the church as such. I think perhaps the greater issue, and the one that really we can't dance around much longer, is indeed the business of progressive revelation. There's no doubt that there are proscriptions against homosexuality in the Old Testament, particularly that inform Judaism and Christianity, and to some extent Islam. On the other hand, there are numerous admonitions to not judge another man's servant, to generosity, to dealing with one's fellow as one wishes to be dealt with, and to the whole idea that the truth will be revealed as humanity is ready to receive it. That is the doctrine of progressive revelation, which would say, and of course those who are arguing for Mr. Robinson's elevation to the episcopacy, as I myself am, let there be no secret about that, those of us who have that position are saying, let's look at what actually the Bible meant and the culture to which it spoke. The minute we say that, though, we imply that that culture is different from this culture, that change has happened and that change will continue to happen. And therein lies the rub. It's a matter of whether change is going to be admitted and of the authority that has to be bent or changed in order for that to happen. These are difficult issues. There are no easy answers, Neil.
I wanted to see if we could get an historical perspective from Larry Cunningham. Obviously, homosexuality and homosexual rights are the issue today. That's what Phyllis Tickle has been talking about. Clearly, people felt very strongly about other issues in the past, Larry.
Yes, absolutely. Could I make a quick point?
Sure.
A very famous Anglican, whom we're also very pleased to hold, John Henry Newman, famously in the 19th century.
No fair.
in a toast, to conscience first and then to the Pope. Catholic
yes.
teaching holds that one must follow one's conscience. One cannot go against one's own conscience. However, it adds the coda in moral theology that conscience must be formed. You can't act out of a crass or an ignorant conscience. On the issue of homosexuality, I think we have to distinguish the state of homosexuality from homosexual acts. And the Catholic understanding is that we do not just go back to the Bible ad literam. The Bible is interpreted in the community of the Church, and it seems pretty clear to me that homosexual activity has consistently and everywhere been condemned, and that is an uncomfortable fact, I think, that the Church has to live with. And I don't think that we can, I think that the idea of progressive revelation is a kind of a naive idea if there are no boundaries set against that. The boundary must be tradition with a capital T within the believing community.
Excuse me. I beg your pardon.
And there I think we might be getting into waters that we may not wish to go in an hour's program.
I think that it may be getting a little bit deep in the context of this discussion. But, Phyllis, I can feel you bursting.
Yes. Well, yes, and I did not mean to interrupt. I apologize. I totally agree with what Professor Cunningham is saying, except that now let me become a good Anglican and say that Anglicanism rests, and discernment has to happen. I think absolutely cavalierly following an uneducated conscience or a willful lack of conscience is craziness. But discernment has to happen. But Anglicanism sits proudly on what we call the three-legged stool, which is that the stool of Anglicanism, the whole building itself of that church, must rest on faith and on reason and upon tradition, so that we try to keep a balance amongst those three parts. Now, tradition says one thing, and Professor Cunningham is speaking to that, as are many of the folk in Minneapolis. Reason says an entirely different one. The understanding of homosexuality now is so vastly different from what it was 3,000, 2,000, 1,000 years ago. So it's a whole different issue. And discerning its way between those two antipodes, between those two positions, is the business of faith. A faith ultimate, none of the three can trump the others or the stool falls. But the business of applying faith to the other two is a painful business, not to be entered into lightly and in any way less than prayerfully. But it is equally naive, I think, to say that that either of those trumps the other. The whole thing comes tumbling down if it does. There have been issues. Remember, 150 years ago, we were having this same fight over slavery. Slavery was seen as biblically empowered. That's foolishness, we think now.
We're speaking with Phyllis Tickle and with Larry Cunningham about the issue of schism. What kinds of issues can divide religions today? And you're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And again, if you joined us late, the presiding Episcopalian bishop, Frank Griswold, said earlier today that the investigation into Gene Robinson, allegations were made against him yesterday just before a final vote was scheduled, that investigation is now complete and a vote has been rescheduled for later today. Stay tuned to NPR News for coverage of that. I wanted to go to an email from Matthew McCurry we got in, Matthew McMurray in Chapel Hill, North Carolina. Are there any individuals supporting a schism in the opposite direction? For example, if the church refuses the new bishop, would individuals leave the church in opposition to this decision? Raising another broader question, he asks, is a schism in the conservative direction the only one possible? I wanted to get answers from both of you. Phyllis Tickle, briefly on the question of the schism in the opposite direction?
I think not. So far as I know, I have not heard of any. I think that the schism usually happens when a minority moves away. That's not always true. But in this case, it's when a minority chooses to move away.
Well, they're talking about in which direction. But in any case, Larry Cunningham, is it historically a group of, I use the word very loosely, a more traditional or a more fundamental believers who say we're unhappy with the direction these new people are going in. We're going to stay true, and they're the ones who form the schism, or is it the other way around?
Well, I think typically it would be people who want to hold on to a tradition which they've inherited that tend to go into schism. I would like to make another point as a non-Anglican, though, and that is that the Anglican communion has a genius, I think, for a kind of suppleness. That is, it has been able to hold, sometimes fractiously, many, many differing tendencies together within the communion of the church. So you can go around this country and see people who still proudly call themselves Episcopalians, but who advertise that they use the 1926 prayer book. That's historically been true of the Anglican communion. My suspicion is that if this ordination or consecration of this bishop goes through, that what will happen will be that if there's a schism, it's going to be a small number of churches, or more likely, as in the case of women's ordination, of individuals either moving to the Orthodox Church or to the Roman Catholic Church or to some small sectarian movement within Anglicanism itself.
Yeah. Mm. Okay. Larry Cunningham, we know you have to leave us, and we thank you for your time this afternoon.
It's been a pleasure speaking with you. Nice meeting you, Ms. Tickle.
Nice meeting you, too.
Yes.
And thank you for that kind remark a minute ago.
Yeah, and I have your book sitting on my desk, by the way.
Oh, that's wonderful. Thank you.
Bye-bye. Thank you, Neil.
Thank you. Larry Cunningham is a professor of theology at the University of Notre Dame, and he was speaking with us from his office in South Bend. When we come back from a short break, we're going to continue our conversation with Phyllis Tickle about the issues that are dividing various religious organizations today and what might cause schisms or splits among those groups. We'll also talk about the explosion that happened earlier today in Jakarta, the capital of Indonesia, and new questions that are being raised about Indonesia's part in the war on terrorism. I'm Neil Conan. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News in Washington.
Thank you.
This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're talking today about schisms and what causes religious divisions. The case in point, the Episcopalian Church, a meeting underway in Minneapolis, is discussing the election of a gay bishop who was selected by the people of his diocese in New Hampshire. Yesterday, allegations were raised against Gene Robinson. Today, an announcement that those investigations have been completed and a final vote scheduled for later today. Stay tuned to NPR News for coverage of what happens in that vote. Our guest is Phyllis Tickle, contributing editor in religion at Publishers Weekly, the author of the Divine Hours series, Manuals for Keeping Fixed Hour Prayers. If you'd like to join our conversation, our phone number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. And the email address is totn@npr.org. And if you'd like to look at a timeline of the development of schisms in Christianity, Judaism, and Islam, you can go to our website, www.npr.org, and just go to the Talk of the Nation page. And Phyllis Tickle, we've been talking about, in the context certainly of the controversy in Minneapolis, about homosexual issues that, as you say, are popping up not just in Episcopalian conferences, but in many others as well. Are there any other major issues out there that could affect divisions in other religious groups?
Well, within very recent history, of course, all through American churches, well, we had to deal with the divorce thing, whether a man who was divorced could indeed become a clergyman, could be accepted as not violating biblical law. Then we had the business of the rights of women. We've had issue after issue over the last 50 years that has come into this, come into play here. But I think what's happening here is much more significant than just schism. I think that it has that, first of all, let's put it in a worldwide or a global perspective. One of the things that's working in Minneapolis is the fact that Anglicanism is an international and hierarchically arranged communion within Christianity. That is to say that the Archbishop of Canterbury, while he is first among equals, still comes near to being the Anglican edition of the Pope. For Anglicanism and for Rome, for Roman Catholicism, there is a real danger that whatever happens in Euro-American communions, whatever happens especially in North American churches, is going to cause a division, worse than a schism even, between what Philip Jenkins calls first world Christianity and two-thirds world Christianity. All of which is to say that if Minneapolis does vote to elevate Mr. Robinson to the episcopacy, there is a real possibility that Anglicans, our co-religionists in Africa, in Indonesia, in places like that, will be faced with the need to sever themselves or to take themselves away from Anglicanism rather than lose the faith of their constituency in societies and in cultures where homosexuality is not yet regarded as a physical phenomenon instead of a sin. Mm-hmm. So that what we've got here, I don't want to go out there and say culture wars and by that kind of slick label avoid a discussion. But what we've got here is something very close to culture war. It's very close to the clash almost between postmodernism and almost a kind of medieval or pre-Enlightenment point of view in many cases. And modernity has come up hard against pre-modernity. And that's a big part of what's happening. The Episcopal Church, Neil, is relatively small in this country. That's the other interesting thing about what's going on right now. Numerically, it's one of the smallest of the communions. The very fact that so much media attention has been focused on what's happening in Minneapolis confirms for me the fact that what we've got here is a total nation, and maybe even a total world involved in what one little small part of it is doing, because the issue matters enormously to far more than the Episcopal Church, and it probably does. I think Philip Jenkins, whose book The New Christendom is the Next Christendom, is absolutely on the mark when he says. He says there is going to be that division.
We just have a couple of minutes with this subject before we move on to Indonesia. Let's see if we can get a question in from John, who's been very patient on the phone in Londonderry, New Hampshire.
Good afternoon. I just wanted to ask Phyllis Tickle a question. I'm a born and raised Episcopalian, and and have been ordained. Went through seminary, and actually had the pleasure of voting as a clergy delegate at the diocesan convention here in New Hampshire for
Good.
Jean, who's a tremendous person. But I wanted to go back to your comments about that three-legged stool of our faith. I've, over the years, heard it in so many different ways.
Yes, that, we do tend to change.
Yeah, faith, reason, and tradition. One of the things that keeps coming back to me is that three-legged faith. For me, it has been tradition, community, and reason. And the Bible is part of the tradition. And that, but I think essentially we're saying the same thing.
We're saying the same things.
But
yes.
The genius of this Anglican tradition, which is ethnic in many ways, in that it started in England, and yet now the English speaking part of the Anglican or commune is the minority.
Definitely.
But the genius is that, as you say, we must balance these things, and one cannot exist without the other. The genius, I think, that we see expressed in Minneapolis, and perhaps the reason that this could only happen, or maybe not, is happening in the Episcopal Church, is that we do have this ability to value our community as much as we value our ability to reason and our traditions. What do you think
yes.
about that?
And if you could keep your thought quite short. I'm sorry, we're just running out of time.
Oh, yes, I think you're absolutely right. I might even go as far as to put your only back in your sentence. And I loved what Mr. Cunningham had to say about the suppleness of Anglicanism. I think if this fight had to be fought, Anglicanism is the arena in which it ought to be fought because of the suppleness, because of the three legs.
John, thank you very much for the call.
Thank you.
And Phyllis Tickle, thanks very much for being with us today.
Thank you.
Phyllis Tickle is the author of The Shaping of a Life, A Spiritual Landscape, and the Divine Hours series. She joined us from the studios of member station WKNO in Memphis, Tennessee.